We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now that's what I call science. Hello, listeners. You're tuned in to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio and podcast show bringing you independent and interesting STEM, so that's science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine, from Tasmania. This show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium news station. So head on over to edge.org.au for more information about them. I'd like to begin today's episode by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording, the Palawa and Pakana. We're recording here on Luchuita, but as we are a podcast, I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from where you, our listener, are tuning in from. On behalf of everyone here in the studio, I pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Hannah Moore. Now, it's a bit of a bittersweet episode because we're coming to the end of our geology mini-series, and specifically, today we'll be talking about tectonic plates. But I'll hand on over to Hannah to introduce our topic and our guest a little bit more.
Thanks, Ollie, and welcome listeners to our fourth and final episode of the Geoscience mini-series, a four-part series where we talk to some fantastic geoscientists based in Tasmania and elsewhere in Australia. Our expert guest today is Dr. Cherie Armistead, a lecturer and researcher at the University of Tasmania. Cherie researches the links between plate tectonics and ore deposits and how the processes involved in these have changed throughout Earth's history. So Cherie, thanks for being on the show with us today. Please tell us a little bit more about yourself and what inspired you to pursue a career in geology?
Yeah, so I guess what inspired me in geology was I was always really interested in things like plate tectonics and volcanoes when I was a kid. Where I grew up in sort of remote Victoria, there were lots of fossils, so I was always really interested in that. And I really enjoyed being outdoors as well. But unfortunately, I didn't really know that geology was a career option or something that you could really study. So I initially started studying engineering and quickly realized that that was not really for me. There was sort of too much maths and physics. So I took a bit of a break and then sort of reading through some courses, realized that earth sciences was something that I could study at university, and it ticked all the boxes of everything I was really interested in. And so, yeah, I started studying geosciences at Monash University and, yeah, really loved it ever since.
Amazing. So can we just go back a little bit, just rewind a little bit and talk about plate tectonics? So for those listeners who aren't familiar with them, would you mind just reminding us what plate tectonics actually are?
Yeah, so the Earth is made up of lots of different layers. So the very inside is made up of the core, which is surrounded by the mantle, and then that's surrounded by a very thin layer called the crust. And so the tectonic plates are that very outer layer of crust and also a tiny bit of the upper mantle. And so the tectonic plates actually move around the Earth, and they also can go back in deep into the Earth through a process called subduction. So they're always moving, they're never still, and that's what I find really fascinating, that the plates are always moving the continents around on the Earth.
What causes them to move? Is that like a natural process or is something inducing that?
Yeah, so there's several processes that drive tectonic plates and sort of lots of different theories for how that occurs. But heat flow in the mantle, so that sort of lower layer, is what's thought to trigger that movement. So you get upwelling of heat in the mantle, and that sort of upwelling can cause plates to sort of tear apart and rift. So that's where you get mid-ocean ridges, so that's where oceanic plates are pulling apart. And then that kind of pushing of those plates then causes them to sink back down into the mantle once the tectonic plate gets thick enough and dense enough to then subduct back down. So, subduction is something that we see in places like South America. So the Andes, the mountain range there, is caused by subduction of the Pacific plate going underneath South America.
Cool. So obviously the Earth is really, really old. Have tectonic plates always been around for the whole kind of time scale that the Earth has been around?
Yeah, so that's a really controversial topic. So some people think that tectonic plates sort of only really kicked off around a billion years ago. That's sort of the sort of extreme younger model. I think the consensus is sort of growing that plate tectonics have probably been around for at least 3 billion years. But then some people suggest that maybe they've been around for 4 billion years. So we sort of don't really know exactly when they kicked off. But we do think by around 3 billion years ago, we probably definitely had tectonic plates.
So what causes difference in those opinions? Like, how would you even begin to work out when they started?
Yeah, well, I think that's where the controversy lies, is it's so hard to find evidence in the rock record for rocks that are really that old. So, and I guess there's that thing of, you know, the absence of evidence isn't evidence for absence. So maybe those tectonic plates 4 billion years ago, we just don't have much evidence of that today on the Earth's surface, because that's sort of the only rock record that we have access to, is rocks that exist today on the surface.
And so where do ore deposits come into this? What about the plate tectonics has influenced the location of ore deposits?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. I think something that I find fascinating about tectonic plates is that they control so many different aspects of the Earth system. So they're interlinked with the climate, the geography, and ore deposits. So we know that most ore deposit classifications, or different types of ore deposits, tend to form in a particular tectonic setting. So that example of the Andes before that I said, that's full of these copper gold deposits that we call porphyry deposits. So basically they're just associated with the magmatic rocks that are coming up because of that subduction zone and mountain range. So we get lots of copper gold deposits in that region. In other regions where we have rifting, so that's where we get a lot of sedimentary related ore deposits. So yeah, ultimately the tectonic plates are driving the geology and the geological processes, which in turn are driving the types of ore deposits that you get in different places around the world.
So some of the listeners might have heard of this term called snowball Earth, and maybe some of the listeners haven't heard about snowball Earth. So would you mind explaining what snowball Earth is? Because it sounds really cool.
Yeah, so snowball Earth is, so there was a period of time in Earth's history, so this is where my PhD research really focused on, called the Neoproterozoic. And so this was from around a billion years ago to 540 million years ago, so right up until the Cambrian explosion of evolution. And so this period of time is probably the most dramatic period of climate in Earth's history that we know of. And so we have these events called snowball Earth, where basically the glaciers, the whole Earth was covered in ice. So today we have polar ice caps, you know, in Antarctica and in the North Pole, but during snowball Earth there would have been ice and glaciers right up to the equator. So if you can imagine there being glaciers in Indonesia today, that's sort of what snowball Earth would have been like. And so that's an example where plate tectonics really influences the climate. And so it's thought that snowball Earth was triggered when supercontinent Rodinia broke up. And so during that continental breakup, there was lots of volcanism, lots of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, and that triggered this snowball Earth cycle of climate events.
That's really cool. And just to think that there were glaciers like on or close to the equator is just madness to think about.
Yep.
All right, stick with us, listeners, for part two as we chat more with Cherie about her past and future work understanding the links between plate tectonics and ore deposits. Here at That's What I Call Science, we're always keen for more sponsors to engage with. If your organisation is looking to financially support the show spreading Tasmania's STEM achievements with the world, get in touch with us via our social media channels or at thatscience.org. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we are talking about understanding the links between plate tectonics and ore deposits. My name is Hannah Moore, and I'm joined by Ollie Dove, along with our expert guest, Cherie Armistead. So, Cherie, you've done a bit of work over in Canada. What were some of the key discoveries that you made from your postdoctoral research over there in Canada?
Yeah, so after finishing my PhD in Adelaide, I moved to the to Canada to the Geological Survey and also working with Laurentian University. And so again, I was looking at plate tectonics, but on the really ancient Earth, so during the Archean. And I was using a global database of lead isotopes, so they're sort of chemical signatures from ore deposits, and trying to see if there were any global scale patterns in these chemical data sets. And we sort of identified that there were these two groups, sort of two M members in those chemical distributions, and they seemed to correlate with supercratons. So throughout most of the recent Earth history, our Earth has been dominated by supercontinent cycles where all the continents come together. But in the Archean, around 2.5 billion years ago, there's sort of these two different models, one where we might have had a supercontinent and one where we might have had two or more supercratons. And so the data that we looked at sort of suggested that we had supercratons rather than a single supercontinent at that period of time.
And what does the data behind that sort of research look like? What sort of things do you need to gather to be able to do the analysis?
Yeah, well, I guess this is one of the cool things about ore deposit geology, because it's quite well funded by the exploration and mining industry. There was so much data that people actually used to understand really small scale processes. So these isotopes can help you understand vectoring within ore deposits. But at a global scale, those data are also super interesting for understanding what's happening in the crust and the mantle, and therefore what's happening with the tectonic plates for further back in time.
So moving forward, you're doing some work in Northwest Tasmania. What exactly are you doing? So it's related to the past connection of Tasmania to North America, which is so cool. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is super interesting. So up until around 10 years ago, people thought the oldest rocks in Tasmania were around 1,000 million years. And so there's been lots of new research done by people at the University of Tasmania, and they've worked out that the rocks in northwest Tasmania are actually much older than this. And so this is Jacqueline Halpin and Jacob Mulder, and so they correlated the rocks in northwest Tasmania with those in North America. And so that suggests that we were once connected to North America over 1 billion years ago. And the other really interesting thing about northwest Tasmania is that there are lots of these little ore deposits, so none that are sort of been mined at the moment, but there are lots of these ore deposits. And up until the work that we've done in the last couple of years, people all thought that they were really young deposits. So in Western Tasmania, there's lots of ore deposits. Most of them are sort of around 400 to 500 million years old. So people just thought these deposits in this really old part of northwest Tasmania were the same age. But we've done lots of new working out how old the rocks are. So that's called geochronology. And so we've done a lot of new dating. And the ore deposits are actually really old as well. So around 1,300 million years old.
Wow. Just then I was trying to, as you were speaking, picture a globe, and I was trying to sort of get Tasmania around to North America in my head. When you go to Northwest Tassie to conduct the fieldwork, what is an average day of fieldwork like there? What sort of things are you bringing back? Are you bringing back samples, or are you looking there sort of thing?
Yeah, so most of what I do, yeah, I guess we go to an area where we know there's some rocks. Luckily for us working in Tasmania, there's been lots of geological mapping done by the Geological Survey, so we're not sort of going in blindly to these areas. So we sort of pick some areas where we think there might be some particular rock types that we're interested in. So we'll go look at the outcrop, work out the sort of relationships between the different rock types, and then take some samples of those rocks. And then when we bring them back to the lab here at UTAS, then we sort of crush them, extract some minerals, and work out how old they are, which tells us how old those rocks are.
And speaking of the techniques that you have back in the lab, if one of our listeners was hearing the episode and wanted to get into this field of work, are those skills that you're using in the lab something that you learn when you're doing it, or do you have to go through, I mean, you have your undergrad courses and things, but just thinking of someone entering this career, how do they get the skills that you use?
Yeah, well, I kind of fell into geochronology. So there's a lot of chemistry involved in geochronology, but I don't really have a chemistry background at all. So most of what I've learned has been sort of on the job learning. Yeah, so there's lots of support to learn those new techniques for people who are interested.
Ah, and do the techniques change a lot over time when someone discovers a new way to do something, or have they been established for a while?
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting time to be a geochronologist at the moment. We've had really great advances in the technology over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. So we're now able to date a whole range of minerals that we weren't previously able to. We're getting a lot of automation in the instruments that we use, which makes things faster and cheaper. And so, yeah, it's really exciting.
Yeah. And then do you end up reaching the, or at least in ecology, it's the inevitable step of the computer data analysis side of things. Do you have a lot of processing to do in that aspect of the work?
Yeah, especially in sort of my PhD and my postdoc work in Canada, there was a lot of using like statistical analysis, that kind of thing, because when you've got such big data sets, you kind of need to be able to quantify the differences or similarities a bit more robustly.
Yeah. And speaking of data, there's a big push nowadays to be a lot more collaborative and have open access data sets so that people around the world can do different things. Given that your field of research involves looking at the entire world, is it quite common to share data across institutions and across countries, or is it still in some fields of STEM, you sort of get people that don't want to share their data because they're going to have something really new and they want to be the ones to look at it? Or is it more collaborative or that kind of?
Yeah, garden? I think there's been a real push to make things more collaborative. So I'm part of this program called Oz Geochem. So it's an AusScope funded, so Australian government funded initiative to try and create a geochemistry database for Australia. So the idea is that when researchers publish their papers or with the data, that they would upload this data and then that would become available to everyone. But we still, I guess, have this thing in academia where people want to be able to publish their work before they share their data too widely. Yeah, and it is difficult when we're looking at global scale things. A lot of these sort of database initiatives are at sort of a country scale, so it is kind of difficult to get some data in some regions of the world.
I can totally understand that.
All right, stick with us, listeners, for part three as we chat with Cherie more about future directions of her research. Hosts on That's What I Call Science don't just hide in the studio, but are known to even step out onto the stage from time to time. If you'd like one of our team to be a moderator for a panel or MC an event for you, we'd love to hear from you via our social media channels or at thatscience.org. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and we're talking today about understanding the links between plate tectonics and ore deposits. My name is Hannah Moore, and I'm joined by Ollie Dove, along with our expert guest, Cherie Armistead. Cherie, what do you see as the future directions of your research in your field, and what potential impact do you think it's going to have on understanding the Earth's geological processes and resources?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in further understanding some of those deposits in northwest Tasmania and how other deposits around the world might be related. And so some of the plate tectonic models that I was part of developing during my PhD research, as well as the geochemistry databases that I was working with in my last postdoc, I'm really interested in integrating those and seeing whether we can see some sort of patterns in where ore deposits form globally in relation to those different plate tectonic processes and where the plate tectonics were at those times. And so one area of this that I'm really interested in is those snowball earth events. We see in places like in Central Africa, those snowball earth stratigraphy, the rocks that form during that event, actually host the world's largest sediment-hosted copper deposits. And we have those same rock types in places in Australia, so in northwest Tasmania, in the Adelaide Super Basin. And so I'm really interested in understanding whether those climatic processes actually also play a role in developing these really large ore deposits and whether we can use that as a tool to potentially find new ore deposits.
Exciting work.
That is. So when you're setting up this work ahead of you, did you come up with the research question and then apply for the funding to do it? Or are you in a position where someone's sort of hired you and you can be like, I want to do this now?
Yeah, so I currently have a grant in application in with the ARC, but these are highly competitive and in most cases, unfortunately, aren't funded because there's just not enough research funding in Australia. But hopefully we can sort of still take this research forward, whether that's through sort of industry partnerships, looking, I guess, more at the applied side of this, of the ore deposit studies or other grant initiatives.
Yeah, the classic. Thinking back over your work and the places that you've been to, you've kind of been across the world, you've experienced some really exciting things. What is one key highlight of your career so far?
Yeah, well, I was really lucky to get to do my PhD on the supercontinent formation of Gondwana. And so most of my research was based in Madagascar. So I got to go to Madagascar 3 times, which was amazing, and it's such a beautiful country. The geology is amazing, the people are amazing, so it was really a highlight every time I got to go there to get to work there.
I have so many questions. I went to Madagascar in 2018. Yeah, that's why I got so excited. When were you there?
So my first field season would have been 2016. I went again in 2017 and then 2019 to run a field symposium.
Yeah. Oh, the 1 year, the gap. Oh, whereabouts in Madagascar were you based?
Yeah, so most of my research was looking across central Madagascar. So that's where we think the sort of highest pressure parts of Gondwana amalgamation occurred. Madagascar was right in the middle of this big orogenic mountain building event. So sort of looking across there to see if we could see any changes in sort of the strain of the rocks that might tell us something about the tectonic processes that happened at that time.
Yeah, I remember the landscape there is very different, and Madagascar's been hit very hard with deforestation and poverty, and it's quite confronting because it's not the Madagascar that you think from the film. It's the country's nothing like that, and I mean obviously there's not lions and zebras,
but or penguins.
But to be there and to see what it's I love Madagascar so much. I'm so that's so incredible that you've also been there. How long were you there each trip?
Yeah, so I would have been there about a month each of the first 2 trips, and then the last trip I went on was sort of a field trip and mini conference that we ran for sort of an international group of people interested in supercontinents and geodynamics.
Yeah. Were you working in collaboration with any organizations or unis in Madagascar?
Yeah, so my collaborator Theodore Razakamanana, he works at the University of Toliara, so that's sort of down in the southwest. Yep, and we also had a couple other field assistants that helped us out.
Nice. Yeah, my field work was north of Tulia.
Oh,
so
yeah,
so
cool.
I went via there. Oh, that's so exciting. And for our listeners hearing about this, sometimes I feel like geology can get a bad rep when it's like, oh, looking at rocks, but you went to Madagascar.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, geology is amazing. It can take you so many places. Yeah, but it is a challenge, I guess, balancing, especially in the mining and exploration side of things, balancing that against the environmental and social aspects as well.
Yeah, and tapping into that, are there any moments in your career when you've seen either misinformation or you've seen something quite confronting that you've then addressed?
I guess the misinformation, I think the biggest thing is so many people still don't understand that all the things they have, you know, your phones, your computers, all that, all the materials that go into that have to come from somewhere. And so if we want to keep those things in our society and our lives, then ultimately we still need to be able to extract more of those resources. Of course, we want to do that in the most environmentally sustainable way we can, and also making sure that socially in the places in the world where we're mining these resources, that those people are being treated well. But we do need to find more resources if we're to keep up with the demands of renewable energy technologies and meeting, you know, net zero targets.
Definitely. We had Owen Misson on a couple of weeks ago who talked about that topic as well, which is something that I totally take for granted. Just the things I use, you kind of just, you go into Kmart and you expect everything to be there and available, but these things have to exist from somewhere.
And our final question of this episode, which I've been asking every guest within this mini series, and it is, what is your favorite rock type and why?
Yeah, I'm probably a bit of a bad geologist that I don't love rocks as much as most people, because I'm much more interested in the bigger picture, the global scale of things. But I think any kind of rock where you can see, you know, deformation, evidence of tectonic plates moving in the past, I really like. So something maybe like a garnet bearing gneiss, where you can see some different foliations, some evidence of, you know, multiple phases of deformation.
I love looking at folding and rocks and deformed rocks that have been through pressure and heat. It's just beautiful patterns, and some of the minerals that are formed from those processes also are gorgeous. So I very much agree with that.
I've loved that question every episode. It's been such a nice way to just hear the four very different answers of the favorite rock. It's been so wonderful, and I'm surprised I haven't made the pun yet that this mini series rocks, like
it really does.
We've got to get that in there at least once. So thank you so much for coming in today, and thank you listeners for tuning into That's What I Call Science. We love bringing you STEM related content, and we really hope you enjoyed the show. If you loved the episode today, you can get in touch with us by searching That's What I Call Science or That Science Taz on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'd like to thank my co-host Hannah Moore for all of her work across the past mini-series, and our expert guest today, Cherie Armistead. So, from the three of us, we hope you all have a wonderful week. This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. That's What I Call Science is brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find the show at all major podcast streaming services and find out more about us from our social media channels. Make sure you like and subscribe to keep up with all the exciting science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine research in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This show is supported and strengthened by Edge Radio, so head over to edgeradio.org.au for more information about them. Thanks for tuning in today, and may your week be STEM-tastic.